So welcome to A Correction Podcast. I'm your host, Lev Moscow. And today we are going to be talking with John Moscow, who is a co-host, but I'm actually really going to interview him. He's not so much going to co-host. And we're joined by Richard Miller, who is a great friend and who was a colleague at the Beacon School. Richard Miller was a history teacher for over 25 years? How long did you teach?
28
years. All right. And you taught at the Beacon School, and you also taught at Central Park East Secondary School. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah, my whole
team. And right now I'm talking to you. You're on the golf course?
No, I just came in from a 3-hour bike ride.
Okay. How many miles did you ride today?
Not so far, but I climbed about 4,000 vertical feet.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
What was the greatest incline? You call it degree, right? Like you go by degrees?
Yeah. Probably the steepest part today was about 17%. That's pretty steep.
Steeper than the hill outside of Old Beacon, right? Where I tried to ride my old Dutch bike up the hill and couldn't make it.
Yeah, Old Beacon was about 7 or 8%.
Oh my God. All right. So today I'm very excited to talk to both of you. We're going to be talking about the 2020 election, presidential election. And every election, it seems like the media tells us that this is the most important election of our lifetime. So I'm wondering, you two are veterans of many, many elections. And I'm wondering if you start to tune that out, or if in fact, each subsequent election is the most important election of our lifetimes. And the second part of the question is, is this in fact the most important election of your lifetime?
Well, I think this is the most important election of our lifetime, but I have not felt that way about every other election. In fact, I don't think I ever really thought about presidential elections in such dire terms, even though I had strong feelings ever since 1972, which was the first election I voted in. And of course, I've been disappointed when I voted for the losing candidate. And I thought some elections were fraught with bigger issues than others, but I never felt like there was a threat to democracy or some incredible problem that would result from the outcome of the election. And even in 2016, because I was consistently listening to a colleague of mine who kept saying that Clinton was going to win every time he walked into my classroom, that I didn't think 2016 actually was as momentous as 2020 will be. So yes, I do think this is a extremely important election. I don't think it's the most important election in American history. I think, you know, that it does not rival 1860 or 1864, which I was not alive for, even though my students used to think I was. And it's probably not even as momentous as either 32 or 40. But it's darn important, and it increasingly I am concerned about the outcome because of the threats to people's voting rights and Trump's own admission that he is considering not accepting the results.
I agree with Richard that I think this is the most important election of my lifetime. And I have not felt that way about a lot of the other elections. In fact, I was trying to remember which ones I actually voted in, because for a long time I just didn't even bother voting because it just didn't seem relevant or worthwhile. And then at some point I sort of started routinely voting. But especially, you know, living in New York or New Jersey, the whole thing has this kind of theatrical air to it because, you know, if the Democratic candidates in particular were ever to be dependent for winning on my vote in one of those states, they'd have a lot more serious problems than getting my vote or not. So it's really this, you know, kind of meaningless exercise in any practical sense. You know, I've been reading, because I'm going to be part of the book club that you're starting, I've been reading the book Sinews of War and Trade by Laila Kilali. And the more I read, the more it's really clear to me that most of these elections the things of real, it's not true that the things of real substance aren't on the ballot, because there's definitely a difference in terms of human rights, in terms of the space that people have for exercising rights, certainly now in terms of things like climate change and so on. Those things are definitely on the table in elections to one degree or another. But, you know, so the economic stuff, like where ports get built and who owns the seas and what the terms of trade are, and all of these things never even get discussed at all. So it's so clear that what we're allowed to vote on is such a narrow spectrum. Doesn't mean it's not important. It just means that some of the most important things aren't even vaguely on the table.
But you're in New Jersey now. Richard, you're in New York. Is there any argument, John, and I'll ask you a similar question, Richard, or same question, Richard. Is there any argument for voting for the Greens in New Jersey? I mean, Trump's not going to win New Jersey. Will you vote Green?
I think in a state like New York or New Jersey, it's one can certainly vote Green, and that it ends up sending a message. I mean, a good friend of mine, you know, just wrote an article sort of arguing in strong terms against any kind of third-party voting, and not just in this election, but in general, pushing for the virtues of the lesser of two evils. But I think that one of the evils of that is, and it's certainly been true, that the Democrats, you know, would love to just ignore anybody to the left and just assume that they can take them totally for granted. The reality is that the Greens aren't really strong enough in a state like New Jersey to really make a difference. But I could see somebody doing that as a protest vote and just saying, I just can't stomach Biden, and so I'm going to vote for, you know, the Green candidate. I think in this election, I do think that people who are in the so-called swing or battleground states should in fact vote for Biden, because I think that the stakes this time around are large enough and important enough that it's worth not spending your vote on the Green Party. But it's interesting, because thinking about past elections, I was very politically active in the civil rights movement in 1964 when, you know, Goldwater was running against Johnson, and, you know, the Democratic Party was basically hysterical about the dangers of Goldwater winning. And they strongly urged, demanded, whatever you want to say, that civil rights groups should suspend demonstrations during the period of the election campaign, because this could turn voters off and could turn the election over to Goldwater. And the civil rights group said no. Said, you know, we're going to keep on demonstrating. We're going to keep on doing what needs to be done. And, you know, yeah, it'd be nice if you win, but don't ask us to stop living and breathing, you know, so that you can define the terms for everything.
Richard, I guess it's the same question. What would you say to somebody who said that they, in New York or New Jersey, was thinking about voting Green?
Well, in general, I would say in most elections, fine, you know, because of the way the electoral system works, it's so clear that Trump would lose and Biden would win, that if you felt strongly, you could do that. I think in this case, and this relates a little bit to some of the historical comparisons that we can look at maybe later on about 1876 and 2000, that the larger Trump loses the national vote by, I think, is important in this case. That I think for some reasons that we can talk about later. But I think if you feel strongly and you're in New York or New Jersey, that's fine. I think in states where there's even a slight chance that Trump could win, even though polls may be saying Biden is up by 5, 6, 8%, I think in this case, it would be important to vote so that Trump loses. And if I could just add one thing about other elections that I did think of, and maybe it was because it was my first election, but I felt like 1972, there was an incredibly stark choice. Because of the war, McGovern had a very, very clear, different position than Nixon. I thought Nixon was running a terrible campaign. So that election felt very dire to me, like, wow, this is really terrible if Nixon gets reelected. I didn't feel that way in 76, and even the elections of 80 all the way, even Bush and Gore, I didn't feel that way. Bush Kerry, I did think was a crazy election. I could not believe that after what Bush had done in Iraq and Kerry's record, that the Republicans could run such a deceitful campaign and undermine Kerry's war record, and it's kind of the playbook that they've been following ever since. So, but I just wanted to add that. But I don't think, I mean, my own view about third-party candidates, as you well know from having excoriated me about it in my classroom a couple of times, is that in national elections, for presidential elections, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I think it makes a lot more sense at the local, state level. But I think for the most part, it's a spoiler vote that has not particularly behooved the candidates in the past. And I certainly don't think this is a good year to be experimenting with it.
Yeah, I would agree that this isn't the year for it. And I agree that in the national level, it is a spoiler vote. And the question is, you know, how in any given situation one feels about that. For example, I do not blame Ralph Nader for Gore's loss in 2000, because I think that, you know, that was that Gore couldn't claim somehow that he was more legitimate than Nader. And if he couldn't carry his own state of Tennessee, and he wasn't willing to fight for Florida, and he couldn't carry Clinton's state of Arkansas, that was a result of his weakness. And that he didn't, I mean, I wish he would have won, but I don't think he could say, well, you can't dare challenge me from the left. Especially because they will ignore people further to the left if they can. I mean, just going back to Bush and Kerry, I agree that it was startling that Bush was able to win that election. On the other hand, I think Kerry played into it. I mean, he lost, I forget whether I voted for him or not. And again, you know, I was in New Jersey at the time, and so I didn't think it made much of a difference one way or the other. But when he bounded onto the stage at the Democratic convention saying, you know, Lieutenant, you know, Kerry reporting for duty or whatever his line was, what I had always respected most about him was when he testified representing Vietnam vets against the war, and he testified to Congress in the early 70s saying, who wants to be the last person to die for a mistake? And I think that Kerry should have claimed that as part of his heritage. Instead, I think he ran a cowardly campaign where he just wanted everyone to think that he was just this, you know, Lieutenant Kerry reporting for duty. And certainly the Bush people would have attacked him no matter what. But I think if you're going to get attacked, stand up for who you are.
I agree. I just want to say one quick thing, Lev. Freddie DeBoer, in addition to explaining that intelligence is inherited, must also explain that political views are inherited, because that's exactly what you've always said about Ralph Nader and Florida. So now I know where you get your...
This is such inside baseball stuff, because, you know, you'd really have to have heard the last Doug Henwood interview to know what Richard's talking about right now.
By the way, I listened to that podcast today on the bike. Very interesting. We'll talk
Both interviews.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I was talking to both of you this weekend, but separately, about the political polarization that we have in this country right now. And Richard and I both listened to Ezra Klein's show a lot. And this last month, he had on a conservative writer, David French. And they were both lamenting, bemoaning the fact that the country is so polarized. John, you said that this period in American history reminds you of the 1850s. Why?
And then you said to me, and how did that end up? Of course, the answer was it ended up in the Civil War. Well, because I think that there was same levels of polarization. I think that you had a situation in Kansas where the president, Buchanan, was openly calling the free staters traitors and sending the military out in alignment with the Southerners to militarily attack them. And things did not look good at all. I mean, most people in the North were not abolitionists. Most whites were not particularly anxious to die or go to war. for a war that, that would have one of its major consequences being, you know, freeing African Americans. And the Supreme Court was extremely right-wing, the Dred Scott decision, basically asserting that literally that black people had no rights that whites, you know, had to respect. So it was a pretty dark time.
Yeah, and I guess my follow-up question is a serious one. Do you think we could have a civil war in the next decade?
Yes.
Richard, what do you think?
It depends. I think there are, I mean, I think your dad's right. I think John's right. It's certainly possible. I think it's not very probable. And I think there's a couple of reasons why. I think the court situation is a little bit different, even though they've got these very conservative judges. And I've been listening to a lot of podcasts about what's going to happen to the court with the new justice being nominated and confirmed. I think Roberts has a desperate desire to keep the court from being seen like the Roger Taney Supreme Court of the 1850s, which was...
Well, can you talk to the audience a little bit about why Taney...
Okay. Well, your dad mentioned the Dred Scott decision. So the 1857 Dred Scott decision is arguably one of the, I don't know, what do you think, John? Three or four, five worst decisions of all time by the Supreme Court,
yeah,
declaring that African Americans had no rights, they weren't citizens, over and above condemning this guy Dred Scott to continue in slavery. So it was a terrible decision. It was so bad that it inflames the political situation that John was describing and is always seen as one of the key last steps, along with the Lincoln-Douglas debates and then John Brown's raid into Virginia at Harper's Ferry, as the steps that lead to the Civil War. So, you know, I think these, you know, we've talked about this a lot, again, in other contexts about trying to make comparisons to the 1930s and the rise of fascism to what's going on in America right now. I don't think civil war is on the horizon. I do think a even more lack of belief in democracy could be the outcome of this election if there's a lot of evidence of tampering with ballots by the right wing and the Republicans, forgetting what Trump is talking about. And I think that's something that we just have to wait and see what happens. As far as I can tell, the only other election that has such obvious voter suppression coupled with shenanigans is the 1876 election, which we can talk about later.
Let's talk about that now. Yeah, what happened?
Well, there was tremendous voter suppression. And I think this is one of the things that makes me really worried about the election, which everyone keeps talking about Biden's, you know, polling lead, and particularly Nate Silver, who I've been following a lot at 538, and the Times' is Nate Cohn. But they always say, of course, this doesn't include voter suppression. And I think that's a horrific, in other words, if they've got their model, I think at this point they have to be including voter suppression in when they're running their scenarios, because it's already happening. There are just this plethora of lawsuits around the country trying to stop all different kinds of voting. I thought Trump's statement that he was going to call on his supporters to be poll watchers was pretty ominous. And I started thinking, like, okay, somebody needs to go to the UN and ask them to send in observers to our election, because it's so out of control.
I think people have actually done that. I think what's bad is, given the relative power of the UN and the US, is that, you know, I'm afraid it's just going to be a rhetorical thing, that it's not a situation where there's some outside presence that can actually do that in a meaningful kind of way. It would be really good, because it's really needed. Everything you're saying is absolutely true.
I mean, the one other thing that I've been thinking a lot about is, and I think this goes back to what John was talking about earlier in terms of sometimes not wanting to vote or thinking voting isn't that important, is that I'm worried that the Democrats are missing out on the significance of getting out the vote efforts. And I think that's the only thing that can really stop what Trump is hinting at, which is a massive turnout, both at the polls when people feel comfortable doing that in terms of COVID, and mail-in ballots and efforts to make sure they're all counted. And I don't think, you know, the polls are that off at this point, that if there is a relatively fair election process that Trump should lose. And I think that and lose fairly decisively at this point. My fear is that everybody's talking about how well Biden is doing in the polls, and then there are going to be so many different legal and extra legal efforts to manipulate the vote that it will turn out, it could turn out badly. If that happens, and it's clear that that's happened, then maybe what John is saying about violence and civil unrest could play out. I mean, I don't know what people would do. I mean, what would you do, Lev, if you were convinced that the election had been really stolen?
Yeah, I guess that would it would depend on what other people around me are doing. I wouldn't want to be the only guy out on the street. John, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I think that this, and this also goes back to that third party issue. I was listening this morning to something on NPR where they were interviewing random people about the debate. And they were interviewing this black law student in Montana who they described as undecided. And they initially made it sound as though he was undecided who he was going to vote for. But what he said made it clear that that wasn't the issue. He said one side is definitely trying to keep people poor. The other side just doesn't care. And that he didn't feel that either side was addressing the needs of black people. And so I think that in addition to getting out the core vote, I think where the Democrats have traditionally been extremely weak is the stuff that Bernie Sanders was talking about the whatever the percentage is, 40, 50, 60% of people who don't in fact vote, even when the media and everybody is telling them that it's the most important election of their lifetimes, that the Democrats, it's not just getting your vote out by going to the door and asking people to come or to mail in their ballot. It's giving people a reason to vote. And that goes back to this question about the Green Party. Is, I mean, what the Greens will tell you, or at least what they said in, you know, the past elections, was that they were primarily aiming at the people who don't feel invested enough to want to vote. And that goes back to the issue with Nader and Gore, is that the Democratic candidates need to earn the vote. They don't inherit it. They don't have a right to it. And what's going to happen is there are vast numbers of people, I think, who aren't going to vote for Trump, but may or may not decide whether they want to bother voting.
That would be on the Democratic Party. And therefore, you know, 2016, that really falls on Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, in your opinion, rather than, you know, Trump being in bed with Putin or Comey.
No, I think it falls on all of them. I think that the, you know, although I'm not that, I mean, I know that the founders were very concerned about foreign influence in elections. But of course, at that point, you know, the United States was this tiny little country and, you know, Britain and France and all the European powers were in the middle of wars with each other and were anxious to get the U.S. involved one way or another. The fact is that the U.S. has intervened in every election that it can find to intervene in around the world. And there is a certain poetic justice that, as Malcolm said, the chickens are coming home to roost, which doesn't mean that I think it's a good thing. But I also, I don't think that the Russians were responsible in a meaningful way for Trump being elected, or that if they were, it was any different from what great powers have always chosen to do. I think that, and I think in terms of the Greens, although again, if I had been in a swing state, I would have voted, you know, for Clinton, but anybody can run for office. The real question is that the major party candidates have to convince people that they should, you know, not heed that siren call, but should vote for them.
Can I dissent for one? I just want to dissent a little bit.
Please.
A couple. The 1876 election, I did a little research today to get ready for this, had the highest voter turnout in American history. 82% of the eligible electorate voted. And part of that obviously was a massive turnout of African-American men in the South. And to some extent, I fully agree with what John was saying. And it was pretty clear in 1876, they had a real reason for voting on both sides. The Republicans were trying to continue the program of Reconstruction. The Democrats were trying to undermine it. The only thing I would say about this election, again, why I think it is different, I think Trump has proven so unequivocally that he's unfit for office, that he's done a number of just incredibly bad things that are deleterious to the country. And I don't think Biden is an amazing candidate, but I think this is one of these elections, like whether it's a question of people holding their nose, but everyone who's going to be affected by a second Trump term, and that's a lot of people, both in the country but and around the world, should go vote. And if you don't love Biden, then just look at the alternative.
I agree with
you. And not to mention all the down ballot elections that are really important for state legislatures, for gerrymandering, for redistricting. And if you can't get out to vote this time, then, you know, I agree that, you know, the Democrats, I don't think, have done a great job of going out and making the case for why they're so much better. Partly they maybe they're thinking, oh, the case is already made. I don't know. But I think people should go out and vote this time.
Well, I agree with you completely. I wish that the Green Party were not campaigning in battleground states. I think that if one's looking at it from a political strategy point of view and responsibilities of a progressive party, I think it's a mistake. I'm just saying they've chosen to do it, and it doesn't do any good for the Democrats to complain about it. The Democrats need to tell people just what you were saying, that you can hold your nose, and in this particular case, you should, and or if you don't, if you like Biden, then don't hold your nose. But in either case, you know, vote. I think the argument I'm making is, I mean, I was not astonished, but depressed to hear what this law student was saying, because
right.
You know, felt shouting at him, you're crazy, man, you're crazy, you know, go and vote. How can you, you know, how can you not choose to vote? But clearly, whatever Biden was saying hadn't convinced him. And the fact that I think that it should have convinced him, not because Biden's so great, but because the stakes are so large, doesn't matter, you know?
That makes a good point, yeah, yeah. Well, you should get that guy's name and call him, John, and have a little talk.
Richard, I want to come back to 1876. What's so interesting about this election? Why do you think it's such a good analog?
A couple of things. One, because the stakes are so high. That the real fight is over the future of Reconstruction in the South. It's somewhat complicated, but basically most of the Confederacy, the old states of the Confederacy, had already reestablished what's called home rule or redemption. But basically it means that the Democratic Party was back in power, and the federal army, which had been occupying the South for a decade, had started to leave or had already left. And they were really only still present in Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina, mostly because those states, the Republican Party still had some power, and they were trying to protect African Americans and their voting and their reintegration into society, opening of businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a real clear choice between the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and the Democrat Samuel Tilden.
Was Hayes a radical?
No, not at all. He's actually pretty mild on protection of African American rights, but Grant had been quite strong, particularly in his first term. His second term is so marred by corruption that it's hard. But the Republicans certainly were much more interested in continuing the franchise for black men and continuing somewhat the program of Reconstruction. But the reason why I think it's interesting to compare it also to now is that the elections are so confused. When the results come in, it's not clear who has won in South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, and Oregon. And Oregon is, maybe John knows more about this since he spent time out there, but there was a whole fight over the electoral votes in Oregon as well. And the long story short, at the end of the night, Tilden has 184 electoral votes for sure, but he needs 185. And I think Hayes has 165. And there are 20 votes electorally that are up for grabs among South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, and Oregon. And there's basically a 4 or 5 month fight over these electoral votes, having to do with contested ballots, having to do with who controls the state legislature, who validates the ballots. And this is something that I think we could see play out in the upcoming election. because of our patchwork electoral system and the fact that it's controlled by states, but ultimately it's also controlled by the national government because of the Electoral College, is we could be in for an incredible array of lawsuits and problems. And, you know, the governor of hypothetically Georgia, Kemp, sending in one slate of electoral votes and someone else in Georgia saying, no, 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 our votes should go for the Democrat. And the whole resolution of the 1876 election came out of a bipartisan electoral commission that they set up by passing a law so they could figure out the result of the election, which I had totally forgotten about until I went back and read about it today. I mean, it's nuts.
And then who wins?
Oh, it's a mystery. I'm not going to know. Hayes ends up winning because they make this deal that he'll become president. And the Republicans say, okay, we'll take the rest of the federal troops out of the South, which means the South can now deny rights to African Americans. And they're supposed to build a railroad through the South as well. That never happened. So, you know, it's a compromise. It's a deal. There's this whole story about a bunch of them getting together in a room in a hotel in Washington and ironing out the details that I'm not 100% sure is accurate. I don't know if you know more about this, John, than I do, but it's a wild story.
No, I don't. But, you know, it clearly was an impact. It was white powers in the North and South, you know, compromising at the expense of African Americans. And, you know, the abandonment of, because as you were saying, most federal troops had already left the South, but this was even just abandoning the remnants of it and essentially setting the stage for the Gilded Age of, you know, sort of rampant capitalism and the growth of business at the expense of African Americans and labor. I mean, I don't know at all. Did questions of labor come up at all in the election? Was that a...
You know, it's a good question. I don't really think it was. The questions of labor dominate the next couple decades of elections, but I think this is really a question of what's going to happen to the program of Reconstruction.
You also mentioned 1940 as a really important election early in the conversation, and I'm guessing it's because if Roosevelt doesn't win re-election, you think that even if Pearl Harbor happens, the U.S. doesn't enter the war? Was that what you were thinking?
I mean, I'm trying to think more. I mean, I think, I was just reading a book about the Germans. I was telling you about this. The Germans were very involved in both the 38 and 40 elections in trying to help undermine the Democrat. And in particular, in 1940, first, getting Roosevelt to not get the nomination for a third term, which was unprecedented. Then also to kind of support Wendell Willkie, the Republican nominee. No, I think it's really important. I think Roosevelt by 40 already sees the coming of the war for Americans. I think he already is moving way ahead of the country in terms of getting away from our policy of not supporting England in the war. He's already moving away from the Neutrality Acts. So I think it was a really important election. I mean, I think 44 is a much more foregone conclusion. It's, you know, I don't even.
So I don't know a lot about Willkie, except that, you know, he later on, you know, became an emissary for Roosevelt and so forth.
Right.
Do you think that his policies, because of being a Republican, would have been substantially different?
You know, it's a good question, John. I don't know for sure. I just think that Roosevelt by 40, in some ways, is sort of at the height of his power. And he's able to, I think, use that to begin pushing the rearmament. He gets the Lend-Lease bill through cash and carry. And I just don't know whether Willkie would have been able to have done all of that as quickly or as expeditiously as Roosevelt did. And I think, you know, Roosevelt makes a lot of good choices that are from 41 on. But Lev, I think your question, yeah, I think Pearl Harbor is a game changer. I think, you know, the question is somehow, it's all counterfactual. somehow Roosevelt not getting elected, does that change our interactions with Japan enough that they don't attack? I don't know. It's a good history paper for your students to research.
I want to say something about that doesn't actually have to do with the election of 1964, but does have to do with the convention, the Democratic Convention of 1964, which I think was one of the most significant few days in the 1960s and in American history, because that was when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was a multiracial, black-led party, wanted to be seated in the Democratic Convention and was pledged to support Johnson, whereas the all-white segregationist Mississippi delegation, everybody knew that they weren't going to support Johnson and were going to support Goldwater, or that the state at any rate and the Democratic Party there was not about to support Johnson. And Johnson, and this was where Fannie Lou Hamer, one of her very powerful presences, and the Hubert Humphrey, you know, essentially who a lot of liberals looked to sort of stand up to Johnson and to fight for the MFDP, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, didn't. And in fact, Johnson told them essentially, if you want the vice presidency, go out and, you know, these are your people, you know, take care of them. Walter Reuther, the UAW, the liberals, basically either to one degree or another didn't stand up for or weren't strong enough to, you know, support the Freedom Democratic Party. And it was, you know, there's James Forman writes about this in The Making of Black Revolutionaries, where he describes what happened in Atlantic City as absolutely critical, because it was really the point where a lot of blacks gave up on the idea that the Democratic Party and the liberal powers that be were really going to fight for them. So in that sense, it laid the groundwork for a lot of what happened in the civil rights movement from that point on.
I want to ask you both the same question. I'll start with John and then Richard. I want you to respond to and evaluate the following argument, which you hear from some people, which is, yes, Trump is bad, but he's not, as Biden said, the worst president in our history, that there's lots of competition. There's Andrew Johnson, for example. There's James Buchanan. There's George W. Bush. There's Ronald Reagan. There's Richard Nixon. There's Coolidge. There's Wilson.
I don't think Coolidge fits in there with the rest of them. I think he's different.
Okay. There's
no Wilson. Wilson shouldn't be in. No, Wilson's absolutely not the same. No, Wilson, come on.
Yeah, Wilson should definitely be in there.
Oh, no, well, not.
You were saying he shouldn't be, or that he should be?
Should not, no, Wilson, Richard likes Wilson more than you do.
I like Wilson, but it's not a question. Wait. We're talking about being a terrible president. Woodrow Wilson is not in the same league as Andrew Johnson and these other guys. I don't think. And frankly, I don't even think Reagan is in the same league as Andrew Johnson. First of all, I don't think. Well, anyway, Biden was wrong in saying that Trump will probably be seen as the worst president. Yeah.
John, yeah, I'll start with you. It seems like there's a lot of bad presidents, a lot of white supremacist presidents, a lot of warmongers. You know, George W. Bush kills somewhere between 600,000 and a million Iraqis. What do you think about the argument that, you know, no, Trump is a normal American president? What he did in the first debate wasn't normal. Some of his rhetoric is not normal, but he doesn't come close to a Buchanan or George W.
Well, I think he's got a good jump off the starting gun for being the worst president. I do think he's the worst president. I think it was it Doug Henwood's show where he was having that discussion about whether Trump is a fascist or not?
Yes.
You know, and I found that argument sort of unconvincing, because I think Trump is a fascist. I think he's a not very good fascist. He's a weak fascist, an ineffectual one, all those things, and ineffective. But that doesn't detract from the fact that if he could be a better fascist, he would be. And I think that yes, I mean, you can go through American history and point to the horrendous things that a lot of presidents have done. But there is a value to the fundamental principles that the society claims it aspires to, even though its actuality very frequently was exactly the opposite. I think that losing those aspirations is a really significant loss, and that there is a difference between a bad bourgeois democracy and fascism, or if one doesn't wants to argue that fascism was, you know, a particular time and place than extreme authoritarianism. There is a difference. And I think that at this particular moment with the existential threat of climate change, that it's just too critical. And that it's if the purpose of that argument, because this is what really matters, is what's the purpose of the argument? If it's an academic argument, you know, where you're pitting Buchanan against and Bush against Trump, who cares? You know, you'll get 50 historians together and they'll give you whatever their lists are.
Well, no, but the reason I'm asking is because, you know, for example, you know, we're now going to be faced with a very conservative Supreme Court where the conservatives have a 6-3 majority. John, you've said in the past that the Supreme Court has really, except for this very short period in the 20th century, never been a friend of progress or a friend of the left. It's always been deeply reactionary. And so I guess why it matters is if this is the normal for America, which is racism and war and imperialism, maybe it's, you know, all this excitement about this election, about Trump, is much ado about nothing. I don't mean it in an
intellectual way. Except it's the times. I mean, just as, you know, just as the Civil War was, you know, and why Lincoln ended up being so important was it was the times and who was going to, you know, act in that way. And right now, aside from anything else, we're talking about the future of the planet. And, you know, just look at California. Look at your TV screen at the fires raging more than they've ever raged before. We don't have the luxury for an academic argument like that.
Well, it's such a complicated question, but I think John is right, first of all, that this discussion of who's the worst president is a fun parlor game, and historians love to play it. But I don't think it's that important right now. I mean, clearly Trump is not particularly successful. We can stipulate to that. And moreover, somewhat what David French was talking about, which is that, you know, these presidential elections have taken on such seeming importance when in fact they're not that important. So while a lot of what Trump says and does breaks all kinds of norms and protocols and is unseemly, you're right that we've had lots of other terrible presidents, and the United States has gone on into a number of wars in our history that are unnecessary, imperialistic, unfair. I somewhat disagree with John. I did like the argument about not calling Trump a fascist because of the what I thought are somewhat weak historical analogies that people have tried to spin, even though there are some interesting parallels. But I think in the American context, in the early part of the 21st century, he's doing a lot to undermine the notion that democracy can work. And I think that connection to the 30s, I think, is interesting, because I think that was clearly the program of Mussolini and Hitler and others, which is liberal democracy can't work. And I still think that it can. And I think Trump is, by his own words, saying, well, I'm not going to accept the election and this and that. And the other thing is astounding that he, as the sitting president, is calling into question the way we go about making choices in a democracy, which is, I think they are deeply flawed. I think that's one other thing that this election is showing. We need a national voting rights bill to get passed that would make sure that everyone can vote. It's amazing, I think, at this point, after having voted a whole bunch of times and always wondered about the voting system, but it's so profoundly broken. And I thought it was so profoundly broken in 2000 after the Bush-Gore debacle that they would fix it. And I think one other thing we haven't talked about much, but I think this really does highlight the Republicans as a minoritarian party who doesn't want people to be voting, because they can't win in elections where most people vote in an open and fair system. And I think that should be exposed. And I think that's one of the things that doesn't get enough attention, which is that we have two parties, one that although they don't do a great job of it, as John was pointing out, of getting people out to vote, says we want everyone to have the right to vote. And the other party says we really don't want it. I mean, look what's happening in Florida with the ex-felons who got the right to vote, and then they're doing everything they can to keep those people from voting. I think there's way too little attention to this, and I think people like Stacey Abrams and others who are trying to get this issue out there are to be commended, and I just hope they're going to be successful this time.
Richard, you said something very interesting where you were saying you still believe that liberal democracy can work. I'm wondering if you can point to, if either of you, but I'll start with you, Richard, can point to a moment in American history when liberal democracy did work for the majority of people.
I mean, I think Reconstruction is a good example of liberal democracy working. You had a tremendous explosion of rights. You have a protection of voting for people who'd not been able to vote. I think the New Deal in the 30s is an example of limited success, because there were definite weaknesses to the New Deal program, particularly for African-American workers and probably women. I think parts of the 60s experiment, civil rights progress, shows that a combination of a people's movement, activists in the streets, of a Supreme Court that is in trying to, I think, reflect what's going on, probably significant national and state majorities of Democratic legislatures at that point. Now, again, you know, I have to really think about this because it's in the context of the Cold War. And so a lot of what's happening in America is to make sure that we don't look as bad as the communists. And that's certainly driving some of the progress of the civil rights movement. But I think those are examples of times that we've seen real progress. I think even in our recent time of the expansion of rights for gay and trans people is an example of a combination of people's efforts, state legislative efforts, and then the Supreme Court reflecting this seems to be something that's happening, is a positive result. Even though Obama and came into office not supporting gay marriage, as an example, and then you end up fairly quickly with a relatively robust expansion of rights.
And I would add, I think the 1976 election after Watergate, where you had a relatively very progressive Democratic Congress, and you had things like the Church Commission and so forth. And, you know, you see both the possibilities and the limitations, because the possibilities were in things like the various environmental things, efforts to stem the power of the president and so forth. Of course, 4 years later, you ended up with Reagan. And you can, in retrospect, you can trace a lot of the stuff that led to Reagan to that 1976 to 1980 period. But at that particular point, it was a case where you had an incredibly criminal enterprise running the White House, and the country was able to respond more or less effectively against that.